I'm Belindy Rowe.
And I'm Justin Carty.
And this is the official podcast of CAMLA, the Communications and Media Law Association.
Welcome, everyone, to the first episode of the CAMLA podcast for 2023. Belindy, it's great to be back.
It sure is. And we have some exciting things lined up for the podcast in 2023. So a big thank you to our returning listeners and a warm hello to anyone joining us for the first time.
Absolutely. And for those who might be new and don't know much about CAMLA, I promise you've stumbled onto something good. CAMLA is an organisation that brings together a wide range of people interested in law and policy relating to communications and the media. CAMLA includes lawyers, journalists, broadcasters, members of the telecommunications industry, politicians, publishers, academics and public servants. If you're interested in anything media and communications, CAMLA is the place to be.
And in each episode of the podcast, we'll be covering topical communications and media law issues and updating you on recent legal and policy developments. All of this while speaking with the superstars of the Australian communications and media law world.
On this episode of the CAMLA podcast, we'll mark the first anniversary of the most recent reforms to the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act, or the SOCI Act. Senior Associate James Wallace and Associates Angelina Yulova and Jack Matthews from Coors Chambers Westgarth join us to look at those reforms.
We'll also hear some highlights live from last year's CAMLA Young Lawyers Networking event in anticipation of this year's event, which is coming up on the 13th of April. So if you're passionate about communications and media law and you're looking to build your network, jump onto the CAMLA website at camla.org.au and grab your tickets today.
So turning to the SOCI Act and cybersecurity, Belindy, there's been a lot going on in this space in the last 12 months.
Absolutely. We've had some significant cybersecurity incidents recently, and these have captured the attention of the public and the government. Because of these, we've seen a sharpening of focus in this space. For example, we now have Australia's first Minister for Cybersecurity, who last year released a discussion paper regarding the development of Australia's cybersecurity strategy from now until 2030. That strategy will be progressed in parallel with the government's other digital and data-related priorities, including the review of the Privacy Act by the Attorney General's Department and the ACCC's Digital Platform Services Inquiry.
And with the Minister for Cybersecurity recently foreshadowing a widening of what constitutes critical infrastructure for the purposes of the SOCI Act, there's clearly a lot of change on the horizon too.
That's right. And with the grace period for the last round of reforms now long gone, it's timely for the owners and the operators of critical infrastructure to review their reporting obligations and ensure their compliance.
Well, on that note, let's dive into our chat with the TMT team from Coors Chambers Westgarth. We're here with Senior Associate James Wallace and Associates Angelina Yulova and Jack Matthews from the Technology, Media and Telecommunications team at Coors Chambers Westgarth. The Coors team join us today to take a look at the amendments to the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act that came into effect in April 2022 and to help us dissect the impact of those amendments on the communications sector. At a high level, the amendments broadened the application of the Act to businesses and sectors across the whole of the Australian economy and expanded the government's powers to address cybersecurity incidents. James, Angelina, Jack, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
If we can jump straight into the questions, then the foundational question, the important question is, what exactly is critical infrastructure? James, could you enlighten us?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's evolving. What's critical infrastructure? It's evolving. So I suppose in its broader sense, it's the assets and the networks and the things that are used to provide essential services to people. It's the things that are used to defend Australia, and it's the things that are critical to our economy. You know, traditionally, we've thought of critical infrastructure as big assets, so things like ports and the electricity grid. But what we've seen is as technologies evolve, really the scope of what's critical infrastructure is changing. And I think that's probably for two reasons. The first is the evolution and emergence of new technologies has meant that things that we didn't used to rely on for our everyday life and to run our businesses, we now do. So think of your internet connection, think of your mobile network, think of the systems you use to store business data. And the other factor is that services which we've, you know, always had, things like healthcare and the financial service sector, they've become increasingly digitized. And as a result, they are at an increased risk of a cybersecurity incident degrading or bringing down their networks and really disrupting Australian life. And so it's really those two factors which have seen a real change in what we would consider to be critical infrastructure. But I might hand over to my colleague Angelina, who's going to maybe talk about some of the specifics about what's been the changes under the SOCI Act, the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act, and the expansion we've seen there in terms of what's critical infrastructure.
Thanks, James. So as James has mentioned, the scope of the SOCI Act has expanded from the traditional infrastructure sectors to 11 sectors that we typically probably wouldn't think of as infrastructure, such as financial services, higher education, food and grocery, and so on. And the implication of the breadth of the scope of the SOCI Act is that many businesses and organisations may not actually be aware that they're caught by this big wide net of the SOCI framework. So within those 11 sectors, there are 22 prescribed class assets. And the definition of a critical infrastructure asset is determined by reference to the specific infrastructure that is core to that specific sector. There is also a broad power for the Minister for Home Affairs to declare any asset which relates to the 11 sectors to be critical infrastructure, though these declarations are private and not available to the public. At a high level, the way the framework of the SOCI Act works is that certain obligations can be switched on through the rules made by the minister in respect of each prescribed asset class. And it is usually the owner or operator of the asset, known as the responsible entity, which has responsibility for complying with the SOCI Act. For example, with telecommunications assets, the responsible entities are carriers or carriage service providers, and for broadcasting assets, it's the owners or operators of the broadcasting transmission assets. It's also worth mentioning that entities that hold an interest of at least 10% in the critical infrastructure asset or have sufficient interest to influence or control the asset are also caught by the Act, which again goes to reiterate the breadth and reach of the SOCI framework.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Angelina, for that. What precisely has prompted the SOCI Act reforms, and how are those reforms relevant to the communications sector? Jack, would you be able to speak about that for us?
Yeah, sure. I think going to what's prompted these reforms, as James mentioned, the scope of assets which are becoming critical to society and everyday life has increased. And as the economy is becoming more interconnected, the scope of assets and systems which require greater security is increasing. On the other hand, we're seeing in parallel an increase in cyber attacks affecting some fairly critical systems and assets. And as these attacks have demonstrated, the impacts are not only devastating on affected individuals, but there can be a wider implication if, for say, a critical system is switched off, such as a telecommunications network. This would have flow-on effects for the entire economy. And the government's view is that there's a lack of capability within the private sector and the critical sectors to adequately address the requisite security, and there's a need for government assistance in responding to these incidents. And because these assets are so crucial to society at large, the government sees itself having a critical role to play in uplifting security, and there's a view that this greater security is achieved through this pooling of resources. And we've seen in recent data breaches, Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill has been quite public in commenting that hundreds of personnel from both the Australian Signals Directorate and the Australian Cybersecurity Centre are working around the clock with affected entities in responding to incidences.
Jack, I'll probably jump in there and say that when you think about the comms sector in particular, it's probably more advanced than other sectors in the economy in terms of its cybersecurity capabilities. And that's for a few reasons. Probably the first is the carriers have made significant investments in the security systems to protect their networks. The other probable reason is that, you know, in 2018, we saw the introduction of the TSSR, the telecommunications sector security reforms. And listeners would be well aware of that work in the telco sector, but that they really put obligations on carriers to do their best to protect their networks, you know, tell the government of major changes they're making to the networks. And it also gives the government powers to issue directions to carriers to do or not to do certain things in the interests of the security of the network. And I think because the telco sector is already regulated in that way, the government's been really mindful not to introduce duplication or overlapping obligations. And so there's been quite a nuanced approach taken to how the telco sector is regulated. And I know we're going to talk about that a bit later on when we get into the nitty-gritty of what are the telco-specific obligations. So I'll save that discussion for then. But really, the thing I would call out is that when it comes to the communications sector, you need to think of the SOCI Act, as well as the TSSR obligations, as well as carrier license obligations recently introduced, in a holistic way, in the way that the communications sector's been regulated.
Thank you both. I guess a further question, and perhaps we can throw to you, Angelina, on this. Could you tell us what parts of the communications sector are considered to be critical infrastructure?
Sure. So as I've already mentioned, there are prescribed asset classes under the Act. And with the comms sector, telecommunications assets include networks and facilities which are owned or operated by a carrier or a carriage service provider and are used to supply a carriage service. And the broadcasting assets include transmitters and broadcasting towers that, for example, are owned or operated by the same entity and are located on at least 50 sites. The rules have also prescribed that the assets of TX Australia are critical broadcasting assets because it services a wide variety of major broadcasters across Australia. However, the list is never truly exhaustive, as again, the Minister can privately declare any asset which relate to the communications sector to be critical infrastructure. This means that, for example, when thinking about the critical telecommunications assets, the RAN, core and transmission networks are going to be considered critical infrastructure assets. However, there is some uncertainty as to whether ancillary IT systems through which a telco might be managing their billing or, for example, customer databases would be captured by the Act. So with respect to broadcasting assets, the focus of the Act is on assets used to provide radio and transmission services. So over-the-top applications and services such as streaming services like Netflix are not covered. We assume this is because broadcast media plays an important role in emergencies and the ability for broadcasters to deliver emergency messages in a crisis. And that depends on the resilience and security of the underlying transmission infrastructure.
Thank you for that, Angelina. Perhaps as a final question, and I'll throw it to you, Jack, for this. Could you explain for us what additional regulations and obligations have now been imposed on regulated entities in the communications sector by these SOCI Act reforms, and how these interplay with the existing regulations?
Yeah, sure. I think these new reforms can be broken down into two broad buckets. On one hand, you've got new government powers in responding to cybersecurity incidences, and these apply across the board to all critical infrastructure sectors and assets. The second bucket is a host of new regulatory obligations imposed on essentially the owners and operators of critical assets. And unlike the powers, these apply on a sector-by-sector or an asset-by-asset basis. They're switched on for relevant assets in legislative rules. So if we look at the first bucket, the government powers first, there are three main powers that the government can exercise following a cybersecurity incident. The first is issuing an information gathering direction. So they can require an entity to provide information about an asset or about the cybersecurity incident. This might be an account of what's happened, the extent to which a system has been impacted, and whether the asset remains operational. And the importance of this information sharing, I think, can be broken into two parts. First is addressing the incident itself and mitigating any consequences. And the second is helping identify other critical assets which may have a similar vulnerability to the same or a similar attack. Stepping up from the information gathering direction, the second power is issuing an action direction. And this is where the government requires an affected entity to do or not do a specific action in response to a cybersecurity incident. This could be as simple as turning off the affected system, but could be as extreme as directing a ransomware response. The final and perhaps the most extreme power is an intervention request. And this is essentially a step-in right the government has to come in and take over and take control of an affected system following a cybersecurity incident. And I think whilst this is the most extreme power, I think it's probably, from what we can tell, the first amongst the Five Eyes Alliance in terms of a government having such a capability.
Jack, is this a last resort? Like, when is the government actually going to want to step in?
Yeah, so that's a good point, James. There are some legislative safeguards in place here. This isn't just a free-for-all right the government has. It has to be not only a proportionate response, but there has to be a consultation with the affected entity and the government has to be of a view that they're unwilling or unable to take the required action.
We know there's been some things reported in the media recently about some big cyber attacks that have occurred. Is there any indication whether the government's used those powers?
I think outside of, as we flagged before, the Home Affairs Minister stating that ASD personnel were assisting in working toward the breach, I think it's unlikely we're ever going to know to what extent these powers are exercised. I think I would assume the government's going to be fairly coy about to what extent its assistance is required in protecting assets. Aside from those government powers, as I flagged, there's the additional scope of the Act, which is new obligations on responsible entities for critical infrastructure assets. Again, there are three main obligations. The first is to register information about an asset with the Australian Cyber Security Centre. The second is to have a risk management plan in place or a program in place for your asset, though the asterisk is that this one's still pending being finalised. And then the final obligation is to report any security incidences to the government, and I guess that's what would trigger those government powers being exercised. As we flagged before, the applications of these obligations vary between sectors. If we look at the communications sector specifically, they apply across the board for broadcasting assets. But for telecommunications assets, as James mentioned earlier, because there's such an existing security and notification regime in place under TSSR, under their carrier license conditions, they haven't been switched on under the Stocky Act for telcos, and instead they've been mirrored as new carrier license conditions. So this really goes to the point that we're trying to avoid, or the government's trying to avoid, a duplication regulation, but these new regulations really need to be looked at in totality with the existing regulatory regimes that the communications sector is subject to.
Thank you for that, Jack. Just on the point of duplication, you know, many of our listeners will, of course, be aware of the data breach reporting obligations under the notifiable data breach scheme. To what extent do those obligations overlap with what is required by SOCI or complement what is required by SOCI?
There is some overlap. I suppose the first thing to think about is that the, you know, Privacy Act notification obligations, they apply in respect of personal information, you know, whereas the SOCI Act obligations apply in respect of cybersecurity incidents. And so it's a much broader test under the SOCI Act. You know, you may necessarily have an incident where personal information isn't affected, such as where there's been a disruption to a network or a system that still needs to be notified. The other thing probably to call out is that the timeframes for reporting under the SOCI Act are much shorter than what's under the notifiable data breach scheme. So, you know, under the SOCI Act for critical incidents, you're talking about a 12-hour notification. And so there's a real need for speedy investigations and notifications to occur. Whereas under the Privacy Act, you know, you've got a 30-day window in which you can make that assessment before you need to notify. And I suppose the other thing to mention is that, and Ange can talk about this a bit further, I think, but you need to comply with both at the same time, and you need to be mindful of that. And I might just let Ange sort of fill in some blanks there.
Yeah, thanks, James. I think the key point to make here is that the notifications under the SOCI Act are in addition to and do not override any obligations that entities might have at law with respect to security incidents. And as we've discussed, that includes the notifiable data breach scheme under the Privacy Act. And I think entities just need to be aware of the different timeframes with respect to each regime and ensure that they're reporting the relevant information for each of those regimes. And just an interesting point is I've seen the OIC actually sort of comment on this point that the SOCI Act does overlap to an extent with the Privacy Act. And I think there's also this sense that there also needs to be collaboration between regulators to ensure that these frameworks are consistent and achieving their objectives.
All right, well, that's a great summary and some great points for our listeners to consider. James, Angelina, Jack, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and your insights today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm here at the annual CAMLA Young Lawyers Networking event. My name's Costa, lawyer from Freehills. One thing I took from tonight is just the importance of preparing for these kinds of things, trying to find some common ground with the people that you want to speak with, and just being authentic.
I'm Lucy. I'm a lawyer at SBS. I'm at the CAMLA Young Lawyers Networking event, and I must say it is a thrill to be back working with people and being in contact with people in person. Key takeaway or key tip is to really dive into every opportunity that comes up, really take things on with two hands and really pursue things that you are interested in and passionate about.
Hi, it's Dan Rowe. I was on the panel this evening as the senior attorney for original production with the Walt Disney Company. My tip for networking for everyone would be to be genuine and authentic in your networking communication and make sure that you follow your gut when you are finding opportunities and exploring new networks to engage with. I find that that's the best measure and it's always served me well and probably will serve you well too.
Hi, I'm Minnie. I'm here at the CAMLA Young Lawyers Networking event. Something that is a big hot tip of mine for networking is just be yourself and listen actively.
Hi, I'm Tom, and my favourite tip for networking is to always follow up with further people that you can connect with from the person that you've sat down and had a chat with, and just keep those connections going.
My name is Rebecca Lindhout. I'm a lawyer at McCullough Robertson, and I was on the panel tonight at the Young Lawyers Networking event. It was amazing to have so many people in the room, and you could really feel how excited everybody was to have a vibrant atmosphere and be connecting in person again. And I think that's probably my key takeaway, is that there's, no matter what you do online, there's nothing like being in the room with people, shaking hands, connecting, and really building a shared experience and getting to know each other.
I'm Chris Chow and I'm the Managing Director of Creative Lawyers. I am a big networker. I love networking and I think it's an absolutely invaluable skill to learn. And if there's something that is a really big tip for me, it is trying to connect on a level that is beyond just the professional level, to really get to know someone and understand how someone is thinking and what their passions are and how they operate, because that is when you'll really understand whether you're going to have a connection with that particular person and whether or not, frankly, they're going to add some value to your life and your profession and your career and everything that you may do.
Some great networking tips there. Perhaps something to help our listeners prepare for this year's networking event on the 13th of April?
Yes, tickets are still available. It's $10 for members and $25 for non-members. If you'd like to come along, or if you'd just like to become a member of CAMLA
and take advantage of the discount tickets,
yes, then please check out our page at camla.org.au.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this episode. But a big thank you to our contributors and to you for listening.
Yes, thank you for listening, and please do join us again for the next episode.
Bye for now.
The CAMLA podcast is the official podcast of the Communications and Media Law Association. CAMLA is an independent organisation that acts as a forum for debate and discussion. It welcomes the widest range of views. The views expressed in the CAMLA podcast are the personal views of the respective authors or speakers. They are not intended to be relied upon as, or to take the place of, legal advice.